The House Committee on Human Services, today, February 6, 2009, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2054. Keeley?
This bill creates a voluntary database in the State Police Law Enforcement Data Center system for individuals with an Axis 1 diagnosis to allow officers to better identify individuals who are in need of special assistance. It also directs DHS to develop the enrollment and revocation forms for the system.
Great. Thank you. Representative Olson is going to present the bill.
Where is he going? He's reading already.
If you haven't learned yet, I have to shut this off.
Oh, thank you for reminding me. Would everybody please turn off their cell phones, their Blackberries, Blueberries, Raspberries?
Yes, please.
Okay. And it isn't enough just
system.
To turn them on mute or vibrate. You have to turn them completely off because our sound system is an old system and it picks up all of those signals. Thank you.
And if you could remember to introduce yourself, give us your name for the
thank
record.
You, Representative.
Thank you. Thank you, Representative.
Very good.
Huffman. Morning, Madam Chair and Committee. My name is Andy Olson, and I happen to be a state representative from House District 15 out of the Albany area. This is truly a neat opportunity for me to be in front of you here this morning to share this with you. There's been a tad bit of effort on a number of people's parts on moving this bill, but it's actually... I think, Madam Chair, you know, it's pretty dear to me from my heart, and it has caused me to shift gears totally from my whole perspective toward folks with mental illness, mental health issues, and just folks that are struggling with medical issues as well. Before I go any further, I want to share with you a story that truly would have helped me years ago. When I was a first sergeant with the Oregon State Police assigned out of the Cottage Grove office, I remember there was a case where I responded to a scene. An individual had stolen some things from a house. It wasn't a criminal act, even though it fit the elements of what a crime was. Now, I say that because the individual had no intent. There was no culpable mental state that was involved with it. And I was aware to some degree that that was the case, that it was probably a mental issue. But to tie yourself up for 3 hours on a police officer hold to have an individual evaluated, it takes a lot of time, and there's other things that you're thinking that you could be doing serving as a law enforcement officer. So the best solution at that point is to place him in jail. It's a lot faster. It's a criminal charge. Yes, that did occur, but you have to get back to the basis of why. 2.5 years ago, Raul Ramirez was the sheriff at that time of the Marion County Sheriff's Office. He shared in front of us during an interim committee judiciary at that time that the county jails were the number one holding facility in our state for the mental health issues. And when I heard that, this hit me really hard like a ton of bricks. I said, it's time now to start trying to do something to the point where could we reach out through the law enforcement data system, LEDS, and maybe create some type of a database where folks at that time, loved ones, the individuals themselves, could put that information data into the system that would make it available for law enforcement to access. It would give them a little heads up on contacts when they're meeting with people out on the road, streets, in homes, wherever. So that kind of gives you the criteria of what drove and stimulated this whole bill. Now, one thing I do want to share with you, because we did move this direction with it last session, and then we were going to have a task force, and that died over on the Senate side toward the end of the session. I was able to move forward with a voluntary group down out of Albany that have a lot of concern toward this. And I will be introducing some folks that were involved in that work group. One is Frank Moore, who's the Linn County Mental Health Director down there, has been extremely helpful for me, and he'll be up here shortly to testify. I was hoping that Virgil and Judy Wilson would be here as well because they're seniors down there, and they also are parents of a son that has been struggling with mental health issues. They have been very helpful. Another was a young mother, Barbara Thayer, has a 17-year-old son. And, Madam Chair, I greatly appreciate this. I know you generally don't do this, but Frank Moore will be reading a letter from Barbara to you. And it's a very it's a hard-hitting letter. That's a, you know, and I think you'll get the picture of what she's been experiencing down there as a young mom with a son. Sean Cleave is going to give you a little bit different perspective. He has a younger brother that has experienced this, so that really kind of narrows it down even more for the whole family perspective of what's going on with this issue. Then I've asked Bob Junedef from Disability Rights of Oregon, Chris Bonif from NAMI will be here, Megan Conahay will be here as well to give you kind of an example from her perspective. Lieutenant Jennifer Bills from Eugene Police Department will be here as well, and I greatly appreciate what she shares, and she has some great thoughts that really align where we're wanting to go with this bill. Terry O'Connell and David Yandell, the Director of Law Enforcement Data System, LEDS, as well, will be here. And then I've also asked a member from the Sheriff's Association, John Powell, will be representing them to share their perspective as well in support of this bill. So at this point, what I would like to do is kind of shift gears in the groups, have Frank Moore. I know the Wilsons are not here, but actually Sean Cleave and Frank Moore, if they would come up and they can share their perspectives, and the letter would be read to you. And once everybody's through, then I'll walk through with you the bill a little bit and some of the changes that I feel are needed to really make this a solid bill and great policy.
Okay. Representative, I wonder if it might not be a good idea to talk a little bit about that first so that that might allay the concerns of some of the people who might be speaking this morning.
Okay. I think probably the easiest way to do this then, Madam Chair, and I appreciate that, is if you were to just take a look at the bill.
Yes.
Pretty simple. It's almost a little more than 2 pages long, one line. At the very beginning, it requires the Department of State Police to create a mental health database. One of the things that I've learned that we really need to do, and Bob Junedef, I greatly appreciate his thoughts on this, is to broaden this a little bit more. And you're going to hear testimony to this point. So one of the things that I would most definitely like to do at the very beginning is shift gears a little bit from that direction, and it be more kind of a medical alertness, awareness, rather than focus specifically on mental health, because there are things outside of the mental health issues that most developmentally disabled, autism, those types of things, too, that would greatly help for law enforcement. If you get down to line 5 and 6, it clearly indicates what it's all about, to provide law enforcement agencies with information that will help. That's the key of the entire bill. But there's two other pieces that go there as well. Actually, it's a three-legged stool concept that where we wanted to go. One was that we wanted to provide protection for the individual, provide protection for law enforcement, and then the third piece is actually we wanted to bring some peace to the families. And I think that we can get there with this. If we jump to line 11, which is section 2, no more than 7 days, what happens at this point here is that when the avenue for a family member or an individual where they're wanting to fill out a form and be entered into the database would go through your local mental health, your county mental health director. And once they've filled out that form, there's criteria, and we'll go through that in the back, where you fill out that form, you have 7 days then to enter that into the database. So there's timelines and there's sidebars on that for moving that forward. The next thing is and I'll go quickly through this here. As we're looking at section 1, we'll go down to line 22, which is subsection 3. The Community Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Director shall, it talks about four different points. The first point being actually the revocation request. And this portion here deals with the removal of the information that's in the database. It can only go through the mental health director of that county to do that. But the first one is revocation. It has some specific guidelines for that. The next one is actually a court order would also give direction to have that removed. The other issue, subsection C, which would be line 30 at the very bottom there of page 1, would talk about when an individual reached the age of 14 for accountability and being able to make that decision themselves. So if they reach that and they want to be removed, they have that right to do that. And then the last one, which is on the second page, line 2, of that talks about 3 years from the date of individual's information. There is a 90-day period, which falls right into the next little subsection D there, or excuse me, 4, line 3, which would give the 90-day notice prior to the 3-year period for how long that information would remain into the database
itself. Could you give me that line again, please?
Yeah, I'm on page 2, and it would be line 3.
Are you okay there, Representative Boone?
We're missing a page.
Look in your file. Okay. I think what was given you today is missing the second page. Look in your file. You should have.
Okay. I didn't bring my file.
Yeah.
No, my question was just basically, I was always under the impression that age of consent was 15. It is 14. It's 14. Okay. Thanks.
Can you find it, Representative?
No.
Did you finally use my copy?
That's fine. Zach's getting us some copies, so
okay.
I'll be fine.
Okay.
We'll just ask Representative Olson to come back and repeat his testimony.
Oh, that, no problem.
Madam Chair, I would prefer to just visit with him one-on-one.
Oh, I think that would be
a lot more effective, I think.
Yes.
Madam Chair, I'm sorry, but through the conversation, Andy, could you repeat on page 2? I'll just make notes and compare it later. Honestly, could you?
Sure.
The line and...
Yeah, line, okay, so as I was finishing out the 4 points of how that information would be removed or could be removed from the database, the fourth point being line 2 on page 2, that is a 3-year limit. And there is an avenue that if you want to just continue rolling that over for another 3 years, you can do that. Now, going to line 7, it directs the Department of Human Services to do 2 things, and that's all of subsection 5 there. It deals with the enrollment form and also the revocation consent form. Then if you drop down to line 14.
So I just want to make clear
that
it's totally... The person who would be in this database, it was totally voluntary.
That is correct.
No one would be on this if they would not be, no one would be required to be on this database.
That's correct, Madam Chair. And I think Bob Junedef actually will share a little bit of perspective, you know, regarding that as well.
Thank you.
But lines, starting at line 14 all the way down to 28, that details what the information is that would be placed in the database. Now, I understand, as Terry O'Connell will come up, and maybe David Yandell, the control that the law enforcement data system is and who has access to it. It is extremely tight. Then line 29, which is subsection 7, there is a mechanism for accountability here, and what it involves is that each county health director will report on an annual time period to your local public safety coordinating council the effects of this program. And the nice thing about that, and I believe that Frank Moore can also share a little bit because he had input as well with us when we were developing that. So it just kind of, all it does is just kind of just confirm a little bit more support for this whole program. Then there's some definitions in subsection 8, and that's the other thing too. As I do, we'll have some discussion here, and I would kind of like to wrap this up a little bit, Madam Chair and committee members, because we do need to go a little bit different direction with what the bill is originally written right now to capture and broaden it a little bit more, and the definitions will apply here, and you'll hear testimony to that effect. I'm feeling very good about where we're going with this, and I think you'll enjoy listening to the testimony. That's pretty much the bill in a nutshell. And if there are any questions, or I'm going to just kind of hang loose down here, but I'd like to have actually,
okay,
if I could have Frank Moore and Sean Cleave come up and testify with me, that'd be great.
Okay. Yes.
I've got a quick question.
Sure.
Representative Olson, thank you. I've been out doing ride-alongs with police officers for many years, and I know how uncertain it is when you show up at a scene and it's dark, and I've always been lucky enough to get to wait in the car as they go into situations unknown, and I really like this idea. My question is around when folks enter this system voluntarily and then they later apply for a job or look to do something and there's a background check done on them, does that show up and could that potentially affect their employment?
Madam Chair, Representative Freeman, that would be a great question to ask with Terry O'Connell or David Yandell when they're here. But I don't want to step out, but I'm not sure about that. I'm almost going to say no.
I think it's a great idea to check with someone who knows. Good question. Okay.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Frank Moore. I'm the Health Administrator for Linn County Health Services. And I have, as Representative Olson noted early on, I have actually two pieces of testimony. I think I can keep my piece very, very short. I'm not here as a health administrator or a mental health director. I'm here as someone who has friends and family members who are affected by mental illness. And quite frankly, when Representative Olson proposed this bill in the last session and there was a hearing in Linn County, because of the nature of the bill and the fact that at that time it was not contemplated that it be voluntary, I testified in deference to the representative neutrally with respect to the bill, but quite frankly, I didn't support the notion of a non-voluntary registration because of my concerns not only for people's privacy and confidentiality, but also just wasn't quite sure where that information would go, and I believe the people with mental illness should always retain a choice when it comes to how they enter our system, whether it has to do with services of my department or any other aspect of how we interface or work with them. I do believe that this bill has a lot of merit and believe that it will over time clearly show that it could, should you choose to pass it forward, believe that it will save lives. And with that, I think I'll end my testimony. I also have the good honor of and privilege of knowing a young woman, and I use that term relatively because everybody seems to be young to me anymore, whose name is Barbara Thayer, as the representative said, and who I have come to know as an advocate in our community for the homeless. And with your permission, and upon Barbara's request, I'd like to share with you some pictures of Barbara and her son, who is the mentally ill individual that we're talking about. It's also very important to me, and you'll see in the last piece of my testimony, that I don't do anything when it comes to Barbara or, quite frankly, her son, Zach, without Zach's permission. And I've met Zach. I've had lunch with Zach. I attended clinical meetings and staffing meetings with him and his parents at the Children's Farm Home when he was hospitalized there or in their residential program, and have come to know and have the world of respect for Zach and his situation in life. I believe, is quite tragic. But I also, as I said earlier, would not do anything without clearly getting Zach's permission to do so. And what you see at the third piece right behind my testimony is permission from Zach for me to have a conversation with you about him and about his family. I also brought the pictures, quite frankly, because it's not a real clinical term, but I've worked in this business for 35 years, and we work with a lot of pretty messed up families whose lives have been dramatically changed by the impact of mental illness, whether it's divorce or single parent families or estranged family members because of the impacts of mental illness. So with that, and the pictures, you get to know a little bit about Barbara Thayer. I will say that Barbara is a very Christian woman who has chosen in life to be an advocate for the homeless and puts in hundreds and thousands of hours every year working with the homeless in Linn County, and that's how I came to know her. It didn't have anything to do with her son, Zach. So with that, I'll read Barbara's testimony. My name is Barbara Thayer. I am the mother of the chronically suicidal son who suffers from a debilitating mental illness. My son has had several psychiatric hospitalizations since the time he was 15 years old. It was my hope that I could testify before you in person to support House Bill 2054. However, having a mentally ill child does not always allow time away from home. My son Zach will be 18 in 31 days. I cannot even begin to describe the countless gut-wrenching nights I have spent awake, worried about my son's safety when he becomes unstable and finds himself wandering the streets where we live or in a city far from home. Just last month, my son had an encounter with local law enforcement. Thankfully, they knew a little of his history and called my husband to come pick Zach up, thus avoiding what could have become a very dangerous, perhaps life-threatening circumstance for both the officer and my son. Now and in the future, my family's journey with my son's mental illness is not a matter of if Zach will have future encounters with law enforcement due to his mental illness, but rather when. House Bill 2054 provides comfort and peace for parents like me who lose much sleep and live in a state of apprehension when our mentally ill loved one is not at home. The potential for contact with law enforcement for minor infractions such as trespassing or loitering is great. I implore you to carefully consider the significant impact that House Bill 2054 could have on family members of a mentally ill loved one, the mentally ill individual as well, and those who have been called to serve and protect as law enforcement officers. House Bill 2054 is not just another bill. It is a humane solution to easing burdens and literally saving lives, perhaps even saving the life of a very special young man named Zach. Thank you for your time, attention, consideration of my testimony. Please feel free to contact me. I think you get the gist of it from there. I would also say that I have, in the kind of the context of this bill, I also have Zach's permission and law enforcement locally in Albany have my number 24 hours a day. So if Zach were to come into contact with law enforcement, they know to call me or call Zach's parents. So in essence, we have already implemented what 2054 contemplates as a bill. So, with that, I'm through. If you have questions, I'll be available either now or all my contact information is on my testimony. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Thank you so much.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Sean Cleave, testifying today on behalf of myself and my family, not for the Farm Bureau for which I work. I guess the best way to start off is just to say that I come from a very middle-class family, a sister, two little brothers. My family moved to South Salem in 1991. And my brothers both attended Sprague High School. My youngest brother went to the University of Oregon, where the stress of school and living on his own and taking care of himself for the first time and being a little bit further away from family, I think, triggered what became mental health illness. it took about a year of time while he was going to school to try to prop him up and deal with his collapses and a bad relationship. But suffice it to say, a year later he found himself in Northern California homeless and dealing with just a slew of bad issues. There was a heroic rescue by my other little brother to extract him from California and bring him back, but he had definitely changed quite a bit. As we worked with him to stabilize his mental condition, both encouraging him to go see some therapists through our insurance and also working with him as family members, he, and I don't have a medical background, but I would describe his state as manic. He would go through periods where he was fine, and then periods where he became very restless and would act out and usually take off to downtown Salem, where he would have numerous interactions with police officers. Now, the problem, and I think you'll probably hear from law enforcement, that eventually these people become somewhat familiar. The problem in his case was he came back to Salem, which is a fairly large city. It took him a while to become familiar with the officers before they knew what was going on. But for about 6 months, every other day, I was getting a call from my mother. I still live in Salem, and she would ask, "Is Ricky there?" And this was part of her standard routine of calling to find out where he was. And the last place she'd usually call was the police, Salem Police Department. And if she waited long enough, they actually have a database where you can go online to find out if somebody had been arrested. And usually, around 4 in the morning, after another sleepless night, she'd find out that he had been arrested. Now, Ricky's been stabilized. He's gone through a modification of the drug court. It's called mental health court. Judge Graves oversees that here in Salem. He's doing really well, and he's about to graduate from a private mental health family therapy program, which is a part of his diversion program. So in the end, we had a system that collected him when he would go into a manic state, still ushered him through as a criminal, and then the judicial branch was able to realize what was going on and put him through a diversion program. Over the interim, I spoke with Representative Olson, and he had described this bill to me just in casual conversation, and I told him probably a more detailed story than I am now, but if this had been in place, it would have benefited my family, law enforcement, and most of all, my little brother. So I see this as a good solution. This is good government. This is good for families. And there were 6 months of sleepless nights when he was home, not to mention before we were able to get him back. But I really think that this bill, House Bill 2054, would have provided a bridge to get us from there to here in a more expedient and less disruptive fashion. So, thanks.
Thank you, Sean. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Sean. Appreciate you sharing that story with us. In Ricky's situation, your family situation, do you think the family would have been able to persuade Ricky to voluntarily go on that list?
That's a very good question, and it was one that I had thought about quite a bit when Rep. Olson had first described this to me. I think there's obviously, just from a personal basis, I think that having an opt-in, a voluntary system, is the way to go. Because of Ricky's manic state, there were definite times of lucidity where he could admit that he was having problems and needed help. So I can't travel back in time and ask the question, but I do think in those periods he would have been more than happy to sign up for something. It was just a snowball effect, and people that deal with mental health issues can attest to this. It's a switch goes off, and it's just a snowball that just becomes something that you can't even rationalize with you know, your friends and family members. So that's what would happen, but there were definite times where I think he would have signed up for this. So thanks for the question.
Maybe somebody can answer this question, but and this is a good example with Ricky's in and out. When you have a record, does that go on his record as just being arrested, or is it more in depth? So it's someone we're looking at it, say, an officer who picked him up and would call it in, and this is before this system would be in place, but would they just say, oh, yeah, he's got a record two feet long and arrested constantly, but without explaining what it's for?
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone, it was a record. It was a rap sheet a mile long. He actually had quite a few run-ins in California, and that was actually part of the reason why he had been selected for the diversion program, because it allowed him to take care of some of the community service that he had to deal with in California. But the arrest record was pages upon pages. There were five times in Salem alone that I know for sure that he was arrested, and my parents had pulled him out. In the end, we ended up, because my family did have some cash that they could draw upon, we ended up with a good attorney who was able to work with the DA to get him into this diversion program. But it was expensive, and those, hopefully, as part of his graduation, those accounts will fall off his record. But they're arrests. They're not a interaction with a police officer with somebody who has a mental health illness.
That's a good question. Ruth Olson, can you respond to that? Because I think what you're saying is, well, not only the fact that he has a mental illness, would that be on the record, but would also his arrest? Is that sort of where we're going with this?
Thank you. Madam Chair and Vice Chair Boone, I think actually, if you wait, I think actually Terry O'Connell from LEDS can answer that even a lot more specific.
Thank you. Any further questions?
Madam Chair, Terry O'Connell is a expert on the LED system?
Yes.
Okay. Thank you, because I have some questions.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much, and I'm sorry about your brother. Thank you for coming to testify, and best of luck with him.
Thank you.
Okay. Madam Chair, if the next three witnesses that could come up would be Bob Jundeff, Chris Boniff, and then also Megan Conahy, I'd greatly appreciate that.
Great. Megan has been here for a while, and we've seen Megan before. Welcome back, Megan.
Yes.
And Bob also. And Chris, who is comparatively new with NAMI.
Excuse me?
I said you're comparatively new with NAMI.
New in my role, but not new with NAMI.
Good. Okay, and what order are you choosing to speak? I think Megan is against this. So do you want to speak first, and then maybe other people can respond to what you've said? Would that make sense to you?
Whatever be your pleasure.
That's fine.
Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Megan Cahay, and I'm grateful for this opportunity to testify in opposition to House Bill 2054. First, I'd like to commend Representative Olson on his exceptional compassion for persons like myself who have mental health challenges and other vulnerable persons. It's clear to me that it is his intent to protect us, and I believe that this is a very noble and worthy goal, and I appreciate this very much. Having said that, I want to explain some of my problems with this bill. Because I have a mental health challenge or mental health issues, and I've had mental health issues since I was 19, and I'm in my early 50s now, I've known personally discrimination, and I have had some instances where I have had encounters with law enforcement. So this bill, throughout my life, if this bill had been in place, this bill would have potentially had an effect on me. I doubt seriously that at any time I would have voluntarily signed up to be enrolled in this bill. I have had some good experiences with law enforcement officers, but I have also had some negative experiences with law enforcement officers. I was telling Representative Olson just a few days ago that I wish they were all as kind and good-hearted as he is, because it would be a wonderful thing if that were so. Part of the problem with this bill is that I believe it reinforces the prejudice and discrimination that people with mental health challenges unfortunately receive. And even if the language of this bill is changed to be that it's more inclusive, a medical database rather than a mental health issues database, I believe that the intent of the bill will still single out people with mental health issues. So change the language and make it more inclusive to persons with diabetes and traumatic brain problems. That would be better, but still I believe that the intent would single out persons with mental health issues and reinforce the prejudice and discrimination that we receive. And that's a problem that I see with it. Also, I have problems with the consent issue. There are potentials for coercion. I understand that this is a very popular bill with parents and guardians of persons that have mental health issues. There are some potential ideas to help make sure that it not be coercive. But even with those safeguards, like having independent witnesses, I'm not convinced that it would still not be a problem with coercion. When you're a mental health patient, a mental health client, you are in a hierarchical relationship. The therapeutic relationship is usually, or if not always, a hierarchical relationship. You have a caregiver, and then you or I have been a client. And if someone suggests strongly that you do something, most often, it's been my own personal experience, I hear it as, do this. And so if there are, as it might be added to this bill, several independent witnesses, I still think that there's a potential for coercion in this bill rather than true informed consent, especially if there are guardians and parents putting pressure on people to do something. I see all kinds of problems. So really what I wanted to suggest is thinking outside the box for this problem. I know that it is a real problem for the interactions between law enforcement and persons with mental health issues. I agree, this is a problem that needs solving, that we need to work on. So I want to say, let's think outside the box. Now, right now, I work in the area of peer support. I'm a peer wellness coordinator for a county. And in my position as peer wellness coordinator, I have had the opportunity to work with the law enforcement of the city where I work. And I have worked as a liaison. And let me give you an example. There was a homeless gentleman who had mental health issues and also a history of violent assault towards police officers. He was in trouble with the law in the city. I had a call from the police. Could you come and act as liaison so that we could serve this gentleman with a no trespass warrant? And they didn't want it to escalate into something more violent. And so I was able to work with the police. I went out, I met the gentleman at a soup kitchen, I established rapport, and reestablished rapport around our love of animals. And then I was able to help be available for a soft intervention when the police went out to serve him with a no trespass warrant and keep the situation from becoming violent. So right now, Dr. Richard Harris, who's the interim director of addictions and mental health, is working on a certification issue for our state for peer specialists, and I'm very encouraged that soon we'll have certification for peer specialists in our state. I'm very pleased with the progress he's making. And when we have certification for peer specialists, we'll have more opportunities for professional peer specialists to work in our communities. And this will pave the way for peer support in our communities. This is a very important step. I'm very encouraged by Richard Harris's work. And this is thinking outside the box for this issue. So thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Thank you for coming, Megan. Any questions? Yes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thanks. Good to see you again, Megan.
Thank you.
Do you see where some of your clients could benefit from being on a registry if they came in contact with situations like you described with trespassing or something else where law enforcement with advance notice because of this database would be able to handle a situation softer?
Madam Chair, Representative Huffman, I would suspect that most of my clients, having what I know of my clients, a lot of my clients have great mistrust of correction of law enforcement officers. I would suggest that most of my clients would benefit from having peer specialists act as liaisons. That is what I would suggest would be most helpful for most of my clients.
I was sitting here listening to the peer support coordinator for a person. I was wondering if this database listed an individual's or a community's peer support coordinator where law enforcement could bring that person in. I was wondering if that might benefit the potentially explosive situation and coordinating the two.
That would be helpful, but see, I think first you would have to get people to sign up for the database, and I think there would be some difficulty getting people to voluntarily sign up for such a database. You know, I think having peer support listed would be a good thing, but really, I think this bill would be most popular with guardians and parents more than actual people that I know who are mental health people with mental health issues. A lot of people with mental health issues. You know, I'm Vice President of Mental Health America of Oregon, and I have contact with a lot of peers who do not have guardianships, who are above the age of 14. And certainly a lot of people that I know would not, with consent, sign up for this. At least that's my take on this.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you, Megan. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you.
We're going to take someone out of order because this person has to leave. So I'm going to ask you if you wouldn't mind stepping down because we have Bill Cluding. He has to be leaving in 15 minutes, so he asked if he could speak. Do you mind?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee, you know, for my folks, this bill would have been
please?
A godsend. For the record, my name is Bill Cluding, and I'm speaking on behalf of myself. This bill would have been a godsend for my parents. My little sister, just younger than me, was Down syndrome. 30 years ago, when Fairview started letting certain people out in group homes here in Salem, she was one of the first ones. Yes, she had very limited capabilities, but yet she had a lot of capability. I don't know how many times our folks lived in Dallas. The phone would ring, and she was at the city police. She lived about 2.5 blocks from a laundromat from her group home, and a couple times she got picked up with that term bag lady. They picked her up and took her downtown. She always had ID on her if somebody hadn't stolen her purse. But she was very good at saying who she was, but she had trouble with her addresses. If they could have just looked at her ID, she wasn't violent or anything. She just didn't want to be pulled around by a stranger, and you can understand why. If they had just looked at her ID, if this database was there, they could have made one phone call to her group home or one phone call to our folks, and it had been solved. But to take her downtown and put her in that atmosphere, it was pretty bad. My little sister passed away in 2002, and my folks are gone now. But this bill would have really helped them. And I'm sure if it would help my little sister, there's more out there. Because, you know, we have these group homes all over Salem. And they're, quite frankly, they're a lot better than the conditions that she was in at Fairview. But I urge you to take a long look at this. Maybe it needs tweaked. But I think it's a good bill. It would sure help my family. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Cluding. Any quick questions of this? Thank you. This person, thank you. Okay.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bob Jundeff. I'm the Director of Disability Rights Oregon. And I want to thank Representative Olson for all the work that he's done on this bill. I know that he's really trying to work to make it be what he wants it to be and to respond to the various interests that come into play in something like this. Our organization serves people with disabilities across the state. We're funded by the federal government. The legislation that funds us on the federal level calls us a protection and advocacy organization. And that term alone encompasses the tension that exists in terms of the types of services that we provide and we try to provide for folks with disabilities in Oregon, in that we work to try to protect people, but at the same time we work to try to preserve their individual rights. And sometimes there is a tension between when you're protecting a person's individual rights and you're trying to keep them safe. And I think that tension exists right in House Bill 2054. And that's why it's taking some time to work through many of the details that, in order to reach that sweet spot, that balance between those two things. As I've approached this bill, I've talked to many mental health consumers who tell me exactly what Megan just told you, which is that many times they rely upon police, and I've had many good experiences with police, but all in all, they're not secure in the idea that an officer knows that they may have a mental illness when the officer approaches them. And that comes out of various experiences, personal experiences, and I would think to some extent it's something that we've tried to address through training of officers. And again, Representative Olson has been very much on board with this and trying to give officers better tools to deal with people with various disabilities. But the fact remains that officers there's going to be a variety of understanding of mental illnesses and the response that people have when approaching a person. If they know, for example, that person has been labeled paranoid schizophrenic, and individuals who might be on a registry have mixed feelings about that. The other thing that we know is that there are many other people who could benefit from the concept of having a registry, not just people with mental illness. And the ones that I've discussed with Representative Olson have been people with developmental disabilities, including autism, Down syndrome, folks with epilepsy, folks who suffered from brain injury, people who have diabetes who may be in a experience a diabetic coma. There are a variety of medical conditions and disorders that can render a person unable to communicate, unable to follow directions from an officer, to react negatively to being touched, and these are things that, if they occur, can obviously lead to bad outcomes on the street. The other thing about the conditions is that while an officer may not know that an individual who they're approaching on the street has a disorder, if they've taken control over that person, they then have a decision to make about where to take the person. And if there is information that allows them to know that there's a family member, there's a friend, there is a professional whom they can contact to get more information, that can be very valuable. And it may be appropriate, if they have that information, to take a person to their home, to the group home, or a medical facility for treatment. So many folks, as we know, end up in jail because that is the only option available under the circumstances to the officer. And our organization responds to many complaints about people, not only with mental illness, but other disabilities who end up in jail. And in a jail situation, you can have the same type of problems that you have on the street in terms of people not getting the medications that they need, not getting the care they need, and not being able to follow direction appropriately, and that leading to discipline rather than to a response to their medical condition. So we have proposed to Representative Olson to try to broaden the scope of this so that it better gets at what the people that we're trying to reach, which are people who, again, because of a medical disorder or disabling condition are unable to follow police directions, may be disoriented and in need of care in their circumstances. We think that there's a fair amount of complexity to this. When you start opening it up in this manner, it makes it a little bit more complex, and therefore I think it would require some administrative rules to be very clear about who's eligible and who isn't eligible and how one goes about determining eligibility. Someone joked to me that every felon will be running down and getting on the registration so that they'll get special treatment when an officer approaches them, and I don't think that's the intent of the bill. And so we would want to have clearly some way to establish eligibility to make sure that that's done properly. Voluntariness is, we've talked a little bit about this, but this is extremely important. As Megan testified, there can be a fine line between voluntariness and coercion. And I worked many sessions ago on an advanced directive for mental health treatment, which we now have in law. And those concerns were voiced then, and there was a concern that for example, a person might be in a mental hospital and be told that we're not going to let you out unless you sign this form. So it's voluntary, but there's a catch. or a treatment professional could say, you know, I really want you to sign this form. It's part of your treatment, and you won't be following this regimen of treatment unless you sign it. The fear that a person is told by a community mental health center, we're not going to serve you unless you sign this form. So these are the types of sensitivities that exist and have been responded to in other parts of Oregon law. So we would want to continue to work with Representative Olson and suggest things like having two signatories who witness the signing of a bill, that they not be the medical. Right now the bill says that the witness is the treating physician. We would want to go exactly the opposite and say that whoever witnesses a form is a disinterested party or parties. And that the form itself has some pretty bold language on it that explains that when you sign this, it's voluntary. It can't be used as a condition for the receipt of any service or privilege. And there'd be a statement for witnesses as well to assure that the person, in the opinion of the witnesses, is doing the signing voluntarily and has the capacity to make decisions of that sort. The one point that's been brought up today that we're also sensitive to is the confidentiality issue. And I know in some other testimony you received or will receive, there's concern that information that goes into the LED system could somehow leak out and be used inappropriately. The two areas that people are most fearful of, I would say, is in employment and insurance. Unfortunately, mental illness and other disabilities still carry stigma in our society, and there's employers who would react negatively to getting that information, would want that information, and insurers as well. So I think it would be important that there be some clear sense that that information isn't going to be used inappropriately. And one last point we talked about is if we are able to broaden the definition, we feel that it would be best to have pertinent information contained in the registry, which talks about not only gives names of others to contact, but also gives some general information about if this, you know, the person, let's say, is sensitive to being touched, is fearful of police, that type of thing, rather than things like diagnosis, because the bill right now calls for a diagnosis to be placed in the registry, and we just don't feel that that a police officer should be making conclusions based upon diagnosis. That some of the diagnoses, particularly mental illnesses, are just so loaded with prejudice that it could lead to types of responses we feel from law enforcement that may not be warranted. So these are the points that we've been working with Representative Olson. He's been extremely open to our concerns. And we want to continue to work with him to make sure that we get a good bill.
Thank you, Bob. Any questions of this witness?
I do. I wanted to ask, and you almost got there, and it sounds like you're working on it, is would it be available to emergency services, for example? And the other thing was, I was thinking of how it would be. Would it be locally in the LEDs? Would it kind of be a local area, or is it regional or statewide?
I think that's maybe not a question to ask about.
Okay. And then I just wanted to comment on that, and I think it would be helpful in certain circumstances. I'll just use an example in my area, in my district. Our fire department responds to calls on the highway, and we have neighbors that we know. One guy does have a touch phobia, and we know not to touch him without plastic or rubber gloves. He also has issues about how you refer to him and things like that, and I've made a note of that. And I think that's helpful because in some times of special events, particularly in the coast, in the summer, we have Hood to Coast, we have that, or we have spring break, which is famous for bringing in extra police, and they're from other areas, and they don't know these people. So I know of two cases where that's happened, and they have been taken into the local jail because they, once the police got them, there was a problem, and one guy was afraid of people in uniform, for example, with things on it. So that was the only thing. Fire department turnouts were okay, but police and even the medical technicians, the EMTs and the ambulance, they had to take their shirts off. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Thank you.
Okay. Oh, let me see. Anybody over here? See nothing? Okay. Go ahead.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Chris Bonneff. I'm the executive director for NAMI Oregon, National Alliance on Mental Illness, an organization that represents consumers and family members. I'll be very brief because I think Bob did an excellent job of highlighting many of the things that we discussed last night at our public policy committee meeting. We're a little late in assessing this legislation. We just had our meeting last night, and we will follow up with some written comments for the record that summarize some of the things I'm going to say. In general, we're very supportive of the concepts of this legislation. Anything that would give law enforcement, who are often first responders in a crisis, one more tool. And we do see this as a tool. It's certainly not a cure-all for the interactions, but it's a tool in their toolkit, along with very intensive training and more understanding how to respond to people in crisis. Anything that would give them more information to make that interaction more successful, leading to fewer arrests, getting people into services, we're very supportive of that, and we're very grateful that Representative Olson has taken a special interest in this. The concept is sorely needed. We do echo concerns that it be expanded beyond just those with suffering with a mental illness or living with a mental illness. I can think of, in addition to some of the conditions that Bob mentioned, people with dementia, and there are probably a whole host of areas that first responders have to deal with where it would be helpful for them to have that type of information. I will touch a little bit on the confidentiality and privacy concerns in a little bit more depth and then conclude. Is exactly when someone voluntarily signs up for this database, what rights will they be signing away? The information that will conceivably be in this database is covered by a whole host of federal statutes. HIPAA, for those with dual diagnosis, 42 CFR, and those statutes dictate how such information is handled. Will law enforcement have to adhere to those statutes? And in those cases, or are we going to ask people to sign away their rights to that privacy? In the medical community, when there is disclosure, improper disclosure, there's a whole notification process under HIPAA and 42 CFR. Law enforcement will have to, and we would encourage that law enforcement and others that would have access to this database be compelled to adhere to those statutes. I mean, they're in place for a reason, to protect people's medical privacy. And there are a whole host of notification and regulations around those. And so one thing that we would want to point out is that implementation of this is more complex than even anticipated in the legislation. And so there are issues such as that we would look forward to working with Representative Olson and others in working out. Also, we do have concerns about some of the mechanics, in that it's still unknown how some of those mechanics would work, and we would want to participate in seeing that we build an ideal system where the mechanics allay some of our concerns, which in large part is because it's concerns of the unknown. We just don't know how some of these things are going to be done, and we would want some of that fleshed out before giving our unequivocal support for any legislation. And the other thing that came up among our membership is, are there models out in other communities where this is used and used to some effect, rather than having us recreate a wheel? We would be interested in knowing where something like this may be used or used effectively, or portions of this concept used effectively, so that, again, allaying some of those concerns of the unknown. And I'll just conclude with that. Again, we're very grateful for this legislation. We do see it in concept as a great tool, so that we have more successful outcomes in the interactions between people in crisis and first responders. Thank you.
Thank you, Chris. Any questions?
Madam Chair, I do have a question. I'm not sure that HIPAA applies in this case at all, that once, I mean, HIPAA is very specific to what entities the information applies to, so within the realm of the medical field. And I'm not 100% sure, but if there's somewhere we could get some answer, and I'm attempting to try to get some more specifics, but I don't think that once it would enter the lead system that HIPAA would actually apply, and you'd have a whole different set of rules under LEADS that it would, that information would apply to.
And we will get that information before our next hearing.
Okay.
Any other questions? Thank you both very much. So, Representative, you want to tell me how
Madam Chair, we have Lieutenant Jennifer Bills from the Eugene Police Department, Terry O'Connell from LEADS, and then also John Powell representing the Oregon State Sheriff's Association.
All right.
Greetings, Chair Tomei and members of the committee. My name is Lieutenant Jennifer Bills. I'm with Eugene Police Department. I'm currently the SWAT commander and also Eugene Police's representative and the department's mental health response leader in charge of the crisis intervention team. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2054, which would create a voluntary mental health database to help law enforcement agencies access needed information to better help a person in crisis. In February of 2008, the Eugene Police Department decided to improve its response to persons with mental illness in need of police services. This came at the recommendation of Eugene's Police Commission and the community at large after a very long public process. From this initiative, the Crisis Intervention Team was formed based on a very successful strategy first introduced by the Memphis Police Department. The Crisis Intervention Team consists of sworn officers who have additional training in responding, communicating, and de-escalating situations involving persons with mental illness or persons in a psychiatric crisis. We also have additional training in responding to and dealing with persons who deal every day with autism, MRDD, and Alzheimer's and dementia. To do their job, CIT officers need community resources such as county mental health facilities, local counselors, and organizations such as NAMI, the National Alliance on Mental Illness. They also need resources to compassionately and safely deal with persons in crisis who may not have committed a crime and may not necessarily meet the criteria for a police mental hold. This current piece of legislation would aid officers in contacting caregivers, counselors, or other agencies which may have a current case on the person in crisis. Oftentimes, the information is out there, but the person most in need of care is unable to share the information with us. This can result in delays in reaching a caregiver, which in turn could cause more stress to the person in need of help. During policy meetings about the crisis intervention team and our mental health response policy, we heard from numerous community members with mental illness who talked about wanting a voluntary database available to law enforcement to better help law enforcement personnel assist them when they're in crisis. During a panel discussion, one person talked about not being able to communicate, being afraid, and having walked from one county to another during their episode. By making the database voluntary, people can opt out or opt in. If someone does not want their diagnosis or their status known, it will not be in the system. But for persons who are most vulnerable and at risk of walking away, this will help. I'd like to share a story with you, if Madam Chair would indulge me. When I was a young police officer, there was a young man whose family had essentially dropped him off in Eugene. They just left him. He was severely autistic and unable to communicate. He was also about 6'5", 220 pounds. And he was very young. He would wander around. He was homeless. He didn't smell very good. And he would be found on people's property, so people would call in trespassing all the time. He wasn't trespassing. He didn't know what he was doing. But our police response would be to come to pick him up. Sometimes he'd fight with us because he didn't understand what was going on. And we'd take him to jail. And we did this over and over again. And this young man, because he was autistic and he was homeless, wasn't able to pay the fines or deal with the issues related to the criminal justice system. But we were the catch-all. So we kept repeating this and repeating this till finally we decided that this was not the right place for this young man. But we didn't know his diagnosis. It didn't come to light till many, many years later after he'd been able to get stabilized and find housing and get taken care of. But we see this every day. Law enforcement has become the catch-all for persons with mental illness. We are the catch-all for dealing with persons with dementia and Alzheimer's who often walk away, with adults and children with autism or MRDD. And if we had a way to be able to contact someone, a family member, a caregiver, a peer support person, their caseworker, instead of taking them to the jail, which is a very long process and not really applicable to someone who has no intent and whose culpable mental state is in question, or to avoid taking them to the hospital or to the mental health facility because that's not really what they need, this would be a great tool for us. Thank you for the opportunity to speak before you. I'll answer any questions you may have.
Thank you. Yes.
Madam Chair, thank you. Just a quick comment. You reminded me of a situation that happened last May. I was at PDX getting ready to fly out to Philadelphia to see family, and my cell phone rang, and it was a friend of mine named Linda, and she was in tears, and she said, "I've been raped." And she's mentally handicapped and would probably test out about, you know, 9 or 10 years old, and Linda's probably 55. And so I immediately got my L.A. onto the police department, which I won't specify the area, but one of my concerns, and then I'm pointing out and maybe directing this to Representative Olson, and I hadn't thought about it until you testified, Lieutenant. Thank you for bringing this up. I would just like to get on record and caution law enforcement that this would not be used, assuming that it gets passed through, it would not be used to respond to a situation in the reverse of what we've been talking about for the individual's protection, and to look at Linda and go, you know, she's... In her case, she would describe herself as simple or challenged, and not take her complaint of, in this case, rape seriously. If she were on this list, or if she weren't on the list, and just that perception, I think that's something that maybe happens. Legitimate complaints are not given full weight because of the situation. So anyway, just wanted to get that on record.
Great. Okay. Any other questions of this witness? All right. Thank you so much for coming.
Thank you.
We'll go ahead and make room.
Oh. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. My name is Terry O'Connell, and I'm the director of LEDS. House Bill 2054 would require LEDS to provide or devise some kind of a database for to include this mental illness category, something that we currently are not doing, and a database that we currently have not constructed. So I know you have several questions.
Okay. All right, sure. Representative Mallory, yes.
Okay.
So these are the questions about how LEDS works.
First off, Madam Chair, I'm almost 100% confirmed that HIPAA is would not apply in a situation once the information went into LEDS. LEDS is not under HIPAA. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, we currently do not have HIPAA data in the LEDS data system. Representative Olson has informed us that HIPAA does not apply in this case,
right.
And then we would have to, I'm sure, to get a AG's opinion to ensure that that's true.
And I'm sure you are not, because you are not a healthcare plan. You're not a healthcare clearinghouse, or you're not a healthcare provider by far.
So next meeting, we'll get an AG opinion on this.
Because I think that is important, because that continually gets drug into
right.
The conversation.
And we'll deal with that.
And so really my question is about who has access to LEDS, what are the rules and statutes around the protection of the information, because it doesn't specifically address protection of LEDS information. So I think that clearly is a huge piece of the information is still sensitive. There's no denying that. But what are the protections around the LEDS system?
Certainly. Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, there's probably three different ways to get access to LEDS, which is Oregon's law enforcement data system. You can be a designated agency and have access to Oregon-only information, or you can be a law enforcement agency, which gives you access to Oregon information and information from other states. The protections surrounding that are as you come into those categories, and we provide each agency that has access based on their statutory authority an ID so that they can access a certain level of information. A regulatory agency would not have access to information such as this, whereas a law enforcement agency would be given full access to this type of information. So we can scale the type of information that's provided to the user based on their statutory authority.
Follow up?
Thanks, Madam Chair. So it would be what happens if someone, what is the penalty for inappropriate use of information?
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, our Oregon administrative rule applies in this for us, and if somebody were to inappropriately utilize LEDS, we could deny that agency access, and then there would be other penalties, I believe, that would come along criminal lines by utilizing information such as this inappropriately.
And then, Madam Chair, one last question, and it has to do with the, you know, we've been talking about mental health, and there's been some, you know, other requests of information be in there. Could you use that same data field? Because I'm assuming it's just a data field, and use the same data field to address multiple physical health, mental health issues.
Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, like I said, we have not built this database yet, so we'd have to look at all the different types of data that would need to be incorporated into this database. It could be a field with a which would have a definition of issues with a person, and we'd have to have a field which would show the point of contact for this person. So we haven't devised this database yet. So any type of information that would need to be incorporated, some of it would fall within the same field, so we would have to look at that when we build this thing.
Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Getting along the same lines of the protection of the information and who has access to the database, I think one of the questions that I've heard come up in several different ways is the impact on potential employment of individuals who are listed in the base, and I would expect that a history of a police record also might have impact on employment. So could you maybe help us understand what sort of access to this database potential employers might have?
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, this would be a standalone issue. It wouldn't be incorporated in somebody's criminal history information. This would be a database which would have a specific query for a specific purpose. An officer would have contact with this individual, and they would have to query on this information specifically. If you were doing a background check for employment on this, we would tailor this query so it would not be available to somebody when they made that query into the system.
Follow up.
But if someone were doing a background check for employment purposes, the criminal history or the police record, in other words, would be available to them?
Madam Chair, Representative Cohen, yes, it would be available. If somebody were to be arrested and those fingerprints were submitted to the State Department, State ID Services Bureau, then that information would be on their criminal history.
Thank you.
So I'm going to follow up a little bit. I thought Representative Cowan might ask this. So would anyone in insurance be able to access this information?
Madam Chair, you mean like the insurance, the medical insurance industry?
Right.
No, they do not have access to LEDS.
Thank you. Representative,
got it covered. That's exactly what I was, yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
Representative Maurer, you look like you have another question.
Well, yes, thanks, Madam Chair. The auditing system and how do you... is there a process to determine whether or not people have violated access to the records? You know, is there a state system?
Absolutely. Madam Chair, Representative Maurer, we currently audit all agencies that have access to LEDS on a triennial cycle. We log every transaction that goes through LEDS. Any query, any type of activity that's LEDS is logged, and then we audit the agencies who access the information and have them explain why they accessed it in some cases if they so need to.
All right. If I, Madam Chair, if I could make a correlation between the access to LEDs and access to medical records, because in our office we have records for Medicaid clients, Oregon Health Plan, and Medicare, which are both government-sponsored programs, and we are not audited on access or who has accessed those specific records. So I think that, in fact, your access system may be much more stringent than ours. Now, if there was a disclosure, of course, all heck would break loose, and that wouldn't be a good thing, and we have controls internally, but there isn't an outside system auditing us on how that record has been accessed. And so, I mean, I just think that is very useful to separate the two systems clearly.
Thank you, Representative. Any further questions? Thank you so much for coming to testify. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
John.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is John Powell, representing the Oregon Sheriffs for Action, the 36 County Sheriffs of Oregon. Madam Chair, I didn't feel like getting up early this morning after this week. It's been very long.
Tell me about it.
I know, you understand. However, on this issue, I was able to get my senses about me and my clothes on. Because in the field of mental health, you're to be congratulated. I know, Madam Chair, care deeply about this, and Representative Olson for really putting his foot down and demanding something happen. The issues surrounding mental health are almost impossible to get your hands around. You have budget issues and all kinds of limitations on how to deal with mental health issues. But in law enforcement, gradually some progress is being made. The training agency now making sure that the new people going through that agency are trained with sensitivity on mental health issues. And now this, with an attempt to give information to law enforcement on how to deal with people. It's one thing to be trained on it, but if you don't know this person has a problem, that training has limited implications. So this is really a step two, I think, in terms of how law enforcement can be improved in Oregon. The lieutenant from Eugene, I think, really gave the sheriff's testimony. The jails have become the last vestige of deposit for the mentally ill. At times, we have 25% of the population in a jail that have mental illness issues, and the jails are very busy places, and it's very difficult to triage appropriately and deal with people in a sensitive way if you don't know why they're acting out, for example. And as the lieutenant mentioned, some people are very, very large and strong. And so if the law enforcement agency knows what they're dealing with, they can do that appropriately. And this system, I think, will allow much-needed improvement in that area. And sheriffs are fully supportive of this.
Thank you, John. Any questions, this witness? Thank you so much especially thank you for getting dressed.
Yeah.
Okay, I think we have several other people who have signed up. Brian DeLashmet, Andrea Meyer. Has anybody else signed up that we're not aware of? Is there anyone else who wishes to speak on this issue?
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Brian DeLashmet. If I were in a courtroom right now, I'm trying to figure out who I'm representing while I'm sitting in front of you, because I have kind of have my foot in a number of places: healthcare, mental health, law enforcement, and corrections. So I'll just describe myself as a friend of the court today. If I was in a courtroom, I'd be a friend of the court. Some of the issues that I had jotted down have been touched upon, but let me kind of reinforce some of the things that have been said. You're all well aware that our mental health system in the state has been basically dismantled. It started roughly 30 years ago with downsizing community mental health system that then was dismantled for lack of funding. And so many of these people, as you've heard, are homeless. They're on the streets. The interaction with police officers is frequent compared to what it would have been 30 years ago. It does create not only a problem with police officers, as you've heard testimony from the lieutenant from the city of Eugene, but it creates a number of other problems that were briefly mentioned. I don't know how many times in my representation of corrections officers, both community corrections officers and state corrections officers, I hear that there is a large portion of people that are incarcerated that have no business being in our system of incarceration. And it creates not only an economic situation in which it's inappropriate treatment, it's inappropriate placement, but also puts the entire system in a jeopardy where the corrections officer often has to intervene on behalf of that person to protect them in those kinds of predatory situations. I bring this to you, and it's not anything new. I have brought this in front of everyone that will listen to me, that we need to solve the bigger problem of our mental health system in the state. This piece of legislation, I've got clients that have said, watch it. I've got just watch and monitor. I've got clients that have said it's a number four priority, which is a low priority, but we oppose it, and I'll get to that in just a minute. But we need to solve the bigger problem. And I know in these economic times that's not going to be easy, but it's a chore that I vow I will continue to press, representing not only my healthcare folks, but my public safety folks as well. The second point that I wanted to mention was that, and you've heard a little bit about this, but these kinds of situations not only put the individual with mental health needs at risk, but they also put the community and police officers at risk. And anything that we can do to minimize the risk to the community, to the individuals, and to police officers is a substantial step forward and very much appreciated. I would like to thank Representative Olson for his effort in this area. I know that one of the previous witnesses said that something to the effect that they wish everybody was like Representative Olson that's in law enforcement. Well, having represented not only state troopers, but local law enforcement and corrections folks, I can tell you that a majority of them are like Representative Olson. The last point that I'll mention is an issue of resources, and this is where the one client has said, watch it, it's a very low priority, but they would technically oppose it. And it's the Oregon State Police Officers Association, it's the state troopers. And it's not a matter of that they don't understand that there's an issue and a concern. Their response was purely fiscal. It was with limited resources, with the fact that we are cutting budgets, including budgets to OSP. They have a concern about OSP having to absorb any cost to create this system. And so we will be very interested as this goes forward to look at how OSP incorporating this additional database, those costs are absorbed. Are they going to be expected to be absorbed internally? If so, what other programs are going to have to be eliminated? So with that, I'll close as, again, a friend of the court and answer any questions.
So I'm going to ask the first question, Brian. So the troopers oppose it because of the expense. They don't want it, the added expense to their budget.
Again, Madam Chair, the Troopers Association, let me make the very clear distinction, does not represent the Oregon State Police. They represent the Troopers Association themselves. Having said that, they understand that the additional 139 positions that they were granted for building up OSP and with potentially a $3 billion plus shortfall, their concern is, are these resources going to be taken away from those positions, and we would lose positions that are badly needed on the streets. So that's purely their concern. They, however, have not taken a position against the concept of this bill. It is purely dealing with the resources and the resource allocations.
Okay. Got it. I think I got it. Thank you. Any further questions of Brian?
Well, now I'm confused. I thought the Troopers Association did represent Oregon State Police.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, in almost all cases, obviously, the Troopers Association is the advocate because OSP themselves, management, they are a part of the administration. And they can take limited positions for or against bills. But make it very clear, the Troopers Association is the collective bargaining agent for the troopers in this state. They represent professional troopers in the state, but not the agency itself. And that's the clarification.
Any further questions? Thank you, Brian.
Thank you.
Welcome,
Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the American Civil Liberties Union of Oregon. Since it's my first time before this committee this year, briefly, the ACLU of Oregon was founded in 1955, and we are part of the national ACLU, and we focus, as many of you probably know, on litigation, often friend of the court briefs, legislation and education on civil liberties and civil rights issues. I'm here today to raise some concerns about this proposal. I certainly do want to acknowledge up front that there are some important safeguards put in place that are, as the gentleman from the LEDS operation has indicated, they would build a separate system. Representative Freeman, you caught on to an issue I was also quite concerned about early on, and also that it would, at the front end, require consent. But I want to go into some of the details in the legislation and draw out a few of our concerns. And overall, you know, there is a powerful tool of technology and databases. And often the desire is to do good. I mean, that is the purpose. But data migrates, data can be misused, data can be, there can be error in data. We need sufficient resources to protect data and databases. So I always hope that we will think of this in the broader picture of ensuring and the balancing of when we add folks and monitor and data that we do so very carefully in our society so we don't become, and I'm not suggesting this bill does, but we don't become a surveillance society as we more and more use the power of technology to watch what we're doing. I wanted to raise one slight concern on the LEDS terminal issue. I believe the testimony was simply that, I mean, there is some auditing done. It's been a few years since I talked to the folks about that, and I certainly wouldn't want to say the status of the funding for auditing right now. But in the past, there has been some concern about just really the ability to fully audit the use of LEDS terminals. They're, as you've recognized, used for by agencies and licensing folks. They have an authorized person, and they are, I think it's intended, they're trained, and they're required to use it the proper way. But we always need oversight, and we need a vigorous oversight to catch those times. You've all heard about the Passport Agency and, President Obama and others, and I think Britney Spears in the hospital, and it's the oversight catching how these systems are misused by folks inside. So it's just important, and again, I want to reiterate, I'm not suggesting that the LEDS terminal or anyone connected to it is misusing it. It's just important to have oversight always when you do this. Some details related to the bill, and I'm going to try to just go down. The department shall...
tell us what line.
Yes, I'm sorry. I'm trying to figure out if I've got the right line. The verifying, and I want to make sure, I apologize. I know, starting on lines 8 all the way down, it talks about the department... community mental health and developmental disabilities program directors are the ones that are going to be inputting and removing the data. And one of their obligations is to verify that the individual has a qualifying mental illness. At the get-go, we have a real concern actually just about entering actual diagnoses versus other kinds of information. The person might be confused. The person doesn't always know their name versus a diagnosis when law enforcement is not trained, I'm certainly not trained, on understanding the implications of a particular diagnosis, and people react, have different traits and different problems that develop from a particular diagnosis. It's not all uniform. But specifically, I just didn't know in what method was going to be contemplated for that they must verify. To whom must they verify this diagnosis? The next line line 16 about express written consent. Feel strongly, especially when you're dealing with folks being asked to enter a database, that not only do they express, they do it knowingly, but that they are also given the full information understanding of what this database is, who can have access to it, how it could evolve, just all the pieces of not just that you'll be on a database for a tool, but again, who can access it in what situations, and make sure that they knowingly understand what they're agreeing to participate in at the front end, not just that they say, yes, I'd like to. So it requires really giving them information. And for some folks, if because it's a vulnerable population and comprehension levels will vary, we want to really make sure that it's done in a knowing way. And I'm speaking specifically of the situations where it's the individual rather than the guardian making that decision. But the guardian needs to know and understand the implications, too. Let me be clear. Everyone should. If I'm reading this correctly, So the individual can seek to be removed from the LED system at any time, but there doesn't appear to be any timeline upon which someone needs to actually make sure that happens. The only timeline I saw in here is 90 days after a three-year period, or within 90 days before the three-year period lapses of someone being on it, they get notice. And there's the requirement that no more than 7 days after the enrollment form is received by the program director get entered. We certainly need to make sure that there is very prompt action taking when someone, be it the guardian or the individual, seeks to be removed. I'm just always concerned, we're always concerned about truly being removed from databases. Because it's timely, I will invoke Brandon Mayfield, data was wrongly secured by law enforcement and others in an investigation. It was rightly necessarily obtained at the front end when he was under investigation, but there's a lot of information about him now that's floating around the federal government, and it's hard to bring it back sometimes when it's out there, even if you're innocent. The concern also about the three-year timeline, that someone automatically stays on up to 3 years, I'm concerned about the length of that time because people move around. And if there's no address change, the notice will be sent to an address where that person may not be. So it may not be meaningful notice to them that the 3 years has expired. And I think it's we just need to be clear on that. Also, then you've got on page two some of the information that the database must contain. And I'm worried. So then you've got on line 16 the individual's most recent diagnosis. I've already mentioned a significant concern about including that. Then you have starting on line 22, contact information for at least two of the following persons. One is the individual's primary care physician. They may not have that. Two is the individual's case manager in the Community Mental Health and Development Disabilities Program. They may not have that. Three is a probation officer. They may not have that. Four is a family member. They may or may not have that. And then any other person willing to serve. I'm concerned you're basically requiring two, maybe situations where there's one. And I'm always want to raise concerns when there's inflexibility, when there's a must or a shall in something, and to make sure if you're really trying to fit it to that individual situation, it might be one person and only one person that they authorize. I have questions about lines 29 to 31. The Community Mental Health and Developmental Disabilities Program Director shall provide the local Public Safety Coordinating Council described in ORS statutes with an annual report on the use of the mental health database. I certainly think that it's important to review and examine the use of this database, how it has been used. What I'm not clear on is why those folks, the program directors, would have the knowledge, and why the local Public Safety Coordinating Council might be one good place, but I think there needs to be the larger picture if this is run through LEDS and Oregon State Police to ensure oversight, to ensure it's doing what it's intended. So I was concerned just about the slight limiting on that. And I'm not sure how they would do that, what access they can get to review people's records that they haven't entered, and so in terms of the LEDS access. We need resources for officers dealing with folks who are exhibiting certain behaviors regardless of the medical diagnosis, and I recognize this issue. In fact, We've worked closely with former chief or retired chief of police Ron Louie from Hillsboro, who, if you had him here in front of you today, would speak passionately about the need for proper training of officers in crisis situations. He's authored a manual called Technical Communication in Crisis Incidents, Interpersonal Crisis Intervention Skills with dealing with People in Stressful Situations. I think he's a strong proponent of significant resources put to law enforcement for the training. This just includes training for law enforcement on how to use the database. What I believe they really need is the training to deal with people, regardless of whether their diagnosis is A, B, or C, who are presenting in certain ways in a crisis situation and aren't listening or are yelling or out of control, and how officers, the action they take there differently than others. Finally, I just wanted to draw your attention to written testimony that was submitted to you by Chris Apgar of Apgar Associates, raising concerns. He is a expert in the area of healthcare, privacy, and security. And Representative Maurer, he did not raise, nor have I, a HIPAA issue on this. So, but he does raise some significant concerns about on this, and I do hope you'll take a moment to glance through his letter, because ACLU's concerns are shared in many ways. With that, I'm happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Andrea. Any questions of this witness? Senator Maurer, you look eager.
Yeah. Well, I asked Andrea to step outside and address some concerns, and in the middle of that conversation, because I'm frustrated sometimes with their position, her position, but she always is rational in many ways and is a compelling figure, and it's very interesting because in that frustration, you all go, yeah, you're right. And so it's more of a comment. There are a lot of things that we need to be concerned about in this, because access to data is clearly a big issue, and you want to have the right data at the right time for the right person and all that. And I just want to say I appreciate your concerns, and I think they're echoed across the board. Anyway, because you rarely do you get to agree with the ACLU, but it's okay.
Thank you, Representative.
Chair Maurer, Representative Maurer. Thank you. Some more than others.
Any other questions? Thank you, Andrew. You brought up some great points.
Thank you.
And I know Mary Botkin. I'm sorry. Could you sit down, please? Thank you. Yeah, thank you. Mary, and if you'd like to sign up, I'll send the staff over to let you sign up. Excuse me, ma'am. I'm sending staff to get your name so you can sign up to speak. Okay?
All right.
Great.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees, and I actually intended to only listen today. But I am compelled to speak for a couple of reasons. We represent pretty much every agency that has been mentioned here today, starting with LEDS and going through the prison system and community mental health. My very first grievance as a new staff representative for the union was a LEDS case. And I can tell you that it was the most challenging grievance I ever had, because LEDS information was so accurate, so detailed, and so comprehensive that the individual who had been accused of inappropriately accessing the LEDS system had virtually no place to stand where she could indicate that she was innocent. And as a result, resigned her position. And that was some 25 years ago. LEDS has only become better and more secure, not less. And, you know, it's very interesting. I understand the concern about information gathering and who has access to it. My bigger concern is that ignorance has created more problems than information has. And I am constantly reminded of this as I work with our officers in the prison system, with our community mental health professionals, that when they don't know who or what they're dealing with, in, especially in mental health, because of the challenges associated with those individuals, the results are so tragic that it is incomprehensible to understand how important the information is that responding officers have, whether they are responding in a prison situation or on the streets. We have seen tragic results in Portland where mentally ill individuals have been shot because they don't understand that they shouldn't do something. They don't respond well to orders being given to officers who are poorly trained and ill-equipped to handle the challenges that they're being faced with. And, you know, I don't know whether we're better at it or worse at it, but there seems to be more and more homeless people who have these challenges that come into contact with our law enforcement community that has been, that has just absolutely not been trained on how to handle people who cannot think in a linear process and cannot respond appropriately. It is not their fault, nor is it the fault of the uniformed officers who are responding. I think that this bill starts a process. I think it's probably not perfect, but it's way ahead of what we're doing now, which is sending officers into a situation where they really don't know what they're handling. In a perfect world, DPSST would train every public safety officer that goes through their training system on how to handle, recognize, and deal with folks who have mental illness issues. We're not there yet, and that is a resource issue. I think that, you know, I watch different law enforcement agencies that we have a relationship with. Clackamas County has a great system in place, but it does not necessarily translate over to another law enforcement agency. And so you have sort of a hit-and-miss effort here. In the Department of Corrections, we have advocated for more than 10 years to have a mental health response team of officers within the system, just like we have a riot response team, just like we have a medical response team, a fire response team, but to have a team that is available to respond to an inmate who is in crisis. Over and over again, we see inmates with very tragic results. One case that I know of for sure ended up in the death of the inmate, not because the officers responded inappropriately according to their training, but because they did not understand that during a psychotic episode, pepper spray was ineffectual. And that ended up costing the inmate his life. Not because of anything they did wrong, but because they just didn't know. And I think that this begins, again, this bill begins a process of knowledge for officers who are responding on the streets of our state. And if we need to fix it or clean it up or make it better next session, then we should do that. But not doing anything is more criminal than doing something a little bit wrong. And I think that, you know, at this point, we really need to think about how we adjust some of the words in this bill to meet some of the most glaring problems, but also to really take a look and say, we're going to take a bold step, we're going to take one step forward and see if this works. And if there's problems, then we'll be the first ones to stand up and say, let's fix it next session. But not doing anything just leads us where we are now, which is a system that's terribly, terribly broken. And, you know, community mental health doesn't have the resources to deal with this, and law enforcement is trying to deal with it, and they don't have the resources either. This will at least give some knowledge to those first responders and those individuals dealing with this client base. It will give them some tools. Certainly not perfect, but at least some tools. And we encourage you to, you know, fix the most glaring problems and move the bill, and let's move forward and start getting some information out there for folks. Thank you.
I'm glad you stayed to testimony, Mary. Thank you. Any questions of Mary Bakken? Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Okay. Norma Walker, is that correct? Thank you, Norma. I'm sorry if I sounded harsh, but I'm, pardon?
It's with an L.
Oh, it's Lorna.
It's Lorna.
For the record, my name is Lorna Walker, and I'm here as a citizen to raise some questions. I think there is real value in having a database available that provides appropriate and useful information firsthand available to people that are offering services, whether it's law enforcement or the extension of various services. Some current concerns that I have about it center upon the fact that within the system there are individuals who are not necessarily schizophrenic, not necessarily drug addicts, but for reasons perhaps beyond their control, they have some type of chemical imbalance or chemical change, I think is a better way to say, that given sometimes specific, rather common and unthought of issues or circumstances, might trigger a need for assistance. It might trigger behavior that would not necessarily be the normal pattern for the individual. And so with that in mind, I think that it's very important that in the establishment of a database that the individual have an opportunity to review what is on there. I think it is important that the information that is on there be used for the benefit of the person rather than, one would hope never, but sometimes things are used against a person instead of for them. And there needs to be some kind of way of ensuring that throughout the system. And there are circumstances in which a person might have little or no contact with law enforcement, but maybe in event of emergency might need special considerations. And it could be helpful to have specified data in an easily accessible system. The plethora of challenges before the law enforcement is, I'm sure, next to overwhelming. And I'm sure that they do the best with it that they know how to do. Or attempt to, at least. Regrettably, sometimes mistakes happen, sometimes because of individual prejudices, sometimes because of lack of information, and sometimes because of misunderstanding of information. Terms can be used to sum up behaviors that they don't have any other name for that carry certain connotations which may not be accurate. So with that in mind, I think that it's important that even if there is a guardianship, that the individual should be permitted to review the data that is in the system and should be able to periodically do so and should be able to have some kind of, I don't know, I want, whether you want to say the word input or some way to make as nearly accurate as possible that which is included. Do you have any questions for me?
I'm going to see if I have any questions.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Lorna, thank you very much for your thoughtful testimony. And I've been around the building about a year and a half, and I just wanted to observe that I think you have probably attended more committee meetings than I have. So it's nice to finally meet you, and thank you.
Well, thank you, Representative Huffman. It's been a pleasure doing so. There's been a wonderful variety of information and a thoughtful questioning that has gone on in the hearings.
Thank you.
Any further questions? Thank you for bringing that up. I've seen Ms. Walker around the halls also, and I appreciate seeing you. And you made a great point, and I think we will be following up on it.
If you have any further question, why I can leave my phone number with you. But
that would be great.
I think that it offers a wonderful potential, but it's so easy to take a generalized term that carries for some people a certain mental set, which may not be necessarily appropriate or applicable, just because sometimes mistakes are made, and sometimes people, when they're making diagnoses, don't find the term that, you know, most appropriately sums up whatever is the question in hand.
I think you make a great
point.
Thank you.
Thank you
for testifying. Representative Olson, did you have anything to add?
No, Madam Chair. He's late to a meeting.
Madam Chair, Andy Olson, thanks again, and committee members for, you know, listening for this past 2 hours on this. I do greatly appreciate that. I will be in touch. I'll stay in contact with you because, you know, there are a number of folks that I need to contact, do a little bit of work, and do some amendments so I can come back here and we can move this forward.
Great. I think you've done an incredible amount of work and good work.
Thank you.
Anything else?
Well, yes. Madam Chair, just briefly, I was skeptical when I knew that it was Representative Olson that was bringing this forward. But I think there's been a lot of good information today, and I look forward to continuing to work on it. Thank you.
Good. I share your sentiments. Thank you. Thank you. All right. I close the work session on the public hearing on House Bill 2054, and I close the Human Services Committee.